¿ya? La cifra oficial ya superó una cantidad de 10.000 que están al extranjero, todo debido a una adopción ilegal.
Se ha descubierto cantidades, pero cifras inmensas de niños que están traficando y vendiendo el Estado chileno corrupto, con todas sus organizaciones para abajo, asistentes sociales, médicos y también registro civil y también embajadas.
Remanentes de un doloroso genocidio que se prolonga hasta hoy. Manuel Arismendi, Hispan TV.
Aquí pensaban seguir ganando el 100% con casas de apartamentos y echar al pueblo a sufrir y seguir de modo cruel contra el pueblo conspirando para seguirlo explotando. Y en eso llegó Fidel y se acabó la diversión. Llegó el comandante y mandó a parar. Y se acabó la diversión. Llegó el comandante y mandó a parar.
El presidente cubano Miguel Díaz-Canel cumple el viernes su primer año de gestión al frente del gobierno de la isla caribeña, marcado por aciertos y dificultades.
Hace exactamente un año, esta imagen selló la histórica transición generacional del gobierno en Cuba. 12 meses después de su elección, el presidente Miguel Díaz-Canel ha establecido un nuevo estilo de gobierno en medio de una situación económica compleja debido a las sanciones más severas de los Estados Unidos, restricciones financieras y la crisis actual en Venezuela, el principal aliado de la nación caribeña.
Díaz-Canel asumió la revolución que le elevó, ¿no? Fidel a todos nosotros. Yo pienso que él, imagínate, está trabajando según sus posibilidades, según los recursos que tenemos. Sabemos que somos un país bloqueado y yo pienso que por lo menos se ha visto trabajando positivamente en varios sectores.
Ahora creo que va en buen camino, ha querido con todas sus cosas poco a poco y ha querido mejorar el país. Ha querido sustituir exportaciones por las importaciones mismas de nosotros, ha querido realzar esto de poco a poco y ha sido un año bastante difícil, pero bueno, hasta ahora desde mi punto de vista como joven creo que va por buen camino.
Realmente lo considero exitoso, exitoso, porque ha seguido la línea del comandante y de la revolución como tal.
Para este analista cubano, el mandatario ha enfrentado un año complejo debido al difícil contexto económico doméstico y el adverso panorama internacional marcado por la agresividad de Washington contra la isla. No obstante, el jefe de Estado ha liderado el país con varios aciertos.
En el plano político, los cambios han sido muchos. Hay una nueva constitución, hay una apertura del espacio público con la apertura de internet, en los datos móviles, con la insistencia del presidente en utilizar los mecanismos electrónicos para la gobernanza. Es decir, tenemos el país ha continuado cambiando y esos cambios han ido en la dirección, aunque quizás no suficientemente, pero en la dirección que ha cambiado la sociedad cubana.
Incrementar la eficiencia económica ha sido su prioridad en medio de un escenario tenso en que los envíos de petróleo desde Caracas han disminuido sustancialmente y las exportaciones no han alcanzado sus ingresos proyectados.
Los problemas están básicamente en que no se ha logrado articular todo lo que implica la reforma económica, todo lo que implica la actualización del modelo económico cubano. Eso todavía está pendiente. Y no ha avanzado con la celeridad que debió avanzar.
Potenciar sectores claves como el turismo, la biotecnología, energías renovables, infraestructura y servicios médicos son las prioridades económicas del gobierno de Miguel Díaz-Canel en los próximos años. Raimundo Urrechaga, Hispan TV.
Y concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RTN, de Telesur, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del Informativo Farco, de Hispan TV y del diario La Jornada. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos. We'll be right back.
next up on Free Radio, it's Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the Thursday, April 9th, 2019 edition. And next up on Free Radio, it's Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the Thursday, April 9th, 2019 edition. I got 2 hours coming at you of a lot of interviews, much of them connected with the debris, the human debris left behind, the wreckage in human lives, or dislocation. Let's not be too theatrical, I guess. People are struggling to address it as best they can, but having to lose 9/10 of your property, no place to go, now facing police harassment for a population that's already vulnerable, being lied to by the city in a city that sort of facilitates a anti-homeless narrative that characterizes homeless people as skunks, punks, and drunks, as one ancient anti-homeless speaker used to put it, or addicts, alcoholics, and crazies, or bums. It's difficult kind of to get past these labels. Simply dodge the police and get a place to sleep, even as the weather turns wet again, as it was today in Santa Cruz. Following up on a lot of that, it's hard to say intended consequences, because the city will probably tell you and believe, the city authorities and workers like Susie O'Hara and Tina Scholl, assistant city managers, who orchestrated the closure of the Ross camp, even though they had no alternate shelter, and then lied about it, misrepresenting what they had to the courts and to the public, and believe that they're telling the truth. Often politicians, in order to be more credible, do persuade themselves of these things. And these people, of course, are the consummate politicians, the real politicians. They don't have to run for office. They're in office forever. They're appointed until such time as we get the city council to actually fire the city manager and hire someone else, assuming they want to keep the current city's structure of government the way it is, which, of course, is probably a big mistake. But let's get into it. Here it is. The show.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
Let's begin for new listeners, and there may be some of those, I don't know. My apologies to those who already know the sad, sad story, or the enraging story of the demolition of the Ross camp and the lies the city told in order to get rid of homeless people there and to present a nice front to both the community and the courts. McHenry on the Bruce Bratton KZSC Wednesday show talking about it. We kind of join him in mid-broadcast. I had a little trouble tuning in, and I got what I got. It was May 7th, a Tuesday show. I think Bruce has several regular shows on KZSC. He's an old codger. Me too. I'm also an old codger. A bunch of old codgers around. Who has always seemed to be, he kind of gives you the latest scuttlebutt on art and music. Movies particularly, I guess, rather than art and music. But also follows city council from the sort of mainstream liberal progressive perspective. He's never done too much, had too much interest in homeless civil rights. But that's kind of been a side issue for progressives who give it lip service but don't really do much about it, particularly if it threatens their electoral victories. That's been the procedure in the past, though it's changed in the last decade or so because the prevalence of homeless people all over the place has become so obvious, and the income inequality and rental profiteering that's driving away traditional people and destroying them, even the liberal progressive base, even with the university's assist in electoral voting, is becoming tangible. So here's Bruce's Keith on Bruce.
I'm Bruce Bratton, and we'll be back in just a minute with Keith McHenry. But right now, let me tell you, the Miriam Ellis International updates, we cleaned up a lot of stuff, but we got no cooperation from the city. So when the original agreement between the camp council and the city was made, where the city was to come in with some staff that would help lift some of the heavy materials out that no one needed anymore, that they had brought there in part as part of their shelter during the heavy rains of this winter, the city failed to show up. And they did not bring dumpsters. We had to do it all, much of it ourselves. Fortunately, the city did come with a truck eventually and took away a lot of the debris that we had stacked up outside the camp. But we had this mediation with the city. We spent 2 days basically in federal court, and we offered a number of solutions that the city could have adopted, as did Drew Glover, which attempted to provide solutions in city council, but was blocked by Mayor Wilkins and by the city manager and by Susie O'Hare, and by, you know, they just continually put roadblocks from the beginning of the year.
What's the justification for the roadblocks?
They don't seem to they claim that they have enough place for everybody. Oh. But if you go downtown, you'll see people living all around downtown. Mm-hmm. So they actually never did. The math doesn't work out. Say if you use their own math, which was a way under count of 150 people in Ross Camp, and you provide 60 locations, that doesn't add up. And they say, well, maybe one or two people could be in this shelter, one or two people could be in that shelter, or...
And by 60 locations means 60 spaces altogether in the three shelters that are currently being offered to not just the Ross Camp refugees or Rough Riders, as some call them, but the entire homeless population in Santa Cruz, any of whom are seeking places to be. There are absolutely no shelter for the overwhelming majority of homeless people in Santa Cruz. And that's always been the case, and it's been the case recently. And the point is that they destroyed makeshift shelters for hundreds of homeless people with the fantasy and the phony story that they had more shelter when they actually had no more shelter. They created a brief 6-day shelter at the Benchlands in the San Lorenzo Park area as a way of luring homeless people away. Originally, it was proposed as a sort of a temporary spot where people would go while they were cleaning up parts of the camp. But that quickly was changed by the decree by City Manager Martin Bernal, who actually has far more power, particularly through his, what I call the eighth council member, Susie O'Hara, at least on homeless issues and housing issues, sort of what she says goes. She acts as though she's the informed person who knows everything. She whittles down the 640 or however many pieces of land and spaces where people could actually set up. The city could establish campgrounds, emergency campgrounds, low-barrier campgrounds, high-barrier campgrounds, whatever they want. And it reduces it to three spots and then to one spot that that they know or should know will not be accepted by nearby neighbors whom it's imposed upon immediately. Or if they're certainly going to face a lot of outcry, as they did in the case of the Depot Park situation. Now, I'm not saying that you should respond to unjustified anxieties by such as the Depot Park neighbors, and those who were organized by anti-homeless people in the neighborhood, in the city, generally. The city shouldn't have to respond to that and shouldn't be able to stand up and speak back to them and say, sorry, these people have got to go somewhere, and this isn't even a campground. This is a situation where people will be coming in at dusk, staying for one night, and then leaving. So don't give me any, you know, if you're concerned about it, well, we'll try to add other campgrounds throughout the city, but we have an emergency situation. Or we can let people stay, as we promised to do, as four people on the council voted, 4 out of 7, a majority, to allow people to stay at Ross Camp, because that's the only place they got right now. But we'll use this maybe as an overflow, so there could be a somewhat more humane, healthy, and decent conditions at Ross Camp, and so it'll be somewhat easier to clean up. They didn't do that. Instead, they cooked up this, identified this one spot at Depot Park, or near Depot Park, actually, a parking lot for a shelter for 60 people, an on-the-ground shelter, maybe under tents for the night that will be taken down during the day. And then they collapsed a week later when there were large protests, 2 weeks later, I guess it was, a week or two later in any case. And they simply reversed themselves and simply eliminated that. And so they had even less shelter than before to be provided for people who they were going to drive out of the Ross Camp, which they then did, claiming it was a public health hazard, suddenly discovering this as a public health hazard. It was a public health hazard in the sense that it certainly needed improvements, but it wasn't something that would be more of a public health hazard than driving people into unsafe situations on the streets and driving them into the hostile arms of neighborhoods that were prepared to make an hostile environment even more hostile. And I guess I've said this many times before on this show, but it doesn't need to be repeated often. It bears repeating again and again. It can't be repeated too many times because it is happening right now, tonight, as we speak. And therefore, it is an emergency crisis now. And people are suffering. Their health, their safety, their sanity, their security is suffering, those folks outside, because of these oblivious, intolerant, and abusive actions by the city government that are masquerading as caring. That's kind of the really sickening thing, although standard for politicians. You know, war is peace, slavery is freedom, and all that sort of thing that Orwell chronicled in his 1984 book way back in the late 40s.
Sometimes they gave the impression that you're just going to have 60 people at the VFW shelter. Well, there's already 60 people at the VFW shelter in many nights. I received photographs from the managers there showing when I've asked to get people in, and he'll send me a photo saying there's no room. And they call them beds, but the beds are actually gym mats on the floor, and you're sleeping shoulder to shoulder, and you have to meet a van at Laurel and Front Street, or a van over by a homeless service center, and you can't walk in, and you get taken there, and you get woken up really early in the morning, and you know many people actually end up missing the Food Not Bombs meal because they got to catch the van before we're serving. Mm-hmm. And so that for many people that just is not working. And we've been, you know, we had a city council had a whole thing where they investigated solutions for the homeless, and they did a report in 2000, and much of that, virtually none of that, was adopted. Then there was Less Freedom Sleepers for 2 years, and finally city council addressed the issue again, and then they had another study that came out in 2017, and most of that has not happened. There's one charging station, like some more charging stations at the downtown library, and then River Street was 1220 River Street was around for maybe half a year, starting out at $90,000 a month or $1,500 per person per month, and then that got abandoned. Ross Camp happens, then and it's just like that. We've been struggling to get solutions in this city for years for people living outside, and city council just kind of diverts attention from any real solutions because, for whatever reason, they don't seem to want there to be any solutions.
This is even the new majority that we have.
Well, this has been very sad. I think Justin Cummings has been extremely disappointing. He could have voted to block the evictions and given the community more time, and he could have backed Drew Glover's efforts, which were really, which are amazing. So Drew had actually brought together people who have lived outside, students that had, you know, background in policy, interns, they did research and studies on solutions for homelessness. They investigated transitional camps in other cities. And he had this amazing proposal, which Watkins would not allow to come to the table and to be discussed. And instead, she would manipulate events with Cynthia Matthews and sadly with Justin and Donna Myers and the city manager's office, city attorney's office, so that in the end, the proposals would never come to be. And then they manipulated things so badly that they, of the, you know, they took off all the solutions off the table, made what they call Depot Park the solution,
which I was talking about before. Manipulation that Keith is talking about, which I've chronicled on this show, sadly, over the weeks as it's happened in the last 3 months, has been, one, declining to put items on the agenda that Drew Glover has proposed and suggested, then filling the agenda with alternate proposals that were essentially a continuation of the false promises and failed deadlines that Susie O'Hara and Tina Scholl, the assistant manager, have been positing again and again in the last 2 or 3 years. In the last year or two, it's been, the focus has been on emergency shelter, because that's where the money is, ultimately large chunks are coming from state and federal government. That the mantra was housing first, and the, you know, emergency shelters were shut down or very severely restricted. Meals were cut off at the Homeless Lack of Services Center in 2015, prompting the beginning of the Freedom Sleepers. There was a big community-led hoopda led by sellout Gon Lame, or Don Lane, as he calls himself, who has for decades, either through default or through... Well, it's actually been pretty explicit. He's refused to support laws, proposals to end the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance, or the, even the more broader, broadly, the camping ordinance itself. In 1999, when a homeless issues task force was appointed by the then supposedly progressive majority, of which Christopher Crone was a member in those days, though significantly less outspoken then than he is now, thank God, although we'll see if anything actually happens as a consequence of even the current movement verbally in the right direction. And when it became a consensus almost around service providers, the Commissioner for the Prevention of Violence Against Women, the city's task force, all the lefty political parties, Peace and Freedom, Green Party, even, I think they're, I don't know about the Democratic Party, they have been always been, as they are now, even more so, now they're kind of a warmongering group with wars when one of their boys is in, when one of their folks, when the Obama is in, and Obama is a bombing away, but, you know, when it comes to Trump bombing, or, you know, even trying to make conciliatory moves towards Russia, oh, he's a Russian spy. It's gotten pretty corrupt in that regard, and I don't know if it's ever been much different in Santa Cruz among the Democrats. Here, you have institutional structures, Democrats and Republicans, that are conduits for people who are paying attention to wealth and power, and it's the wealthy who are powerful and the wealthy who call the shots. Real estate interests here, local businesses that are big businesses downtown, the boardwalk, the university, all these centers of power. And I don't mean the student vote, I mean the University of California administration. hope when Cummings and Glover were elected, because with the two holdovers, Brown and Crone, who were notably remarkable in the first 2 years of their term, it's hard for me to find much to say that's positive about either of them. There's certainly some small things. I mean, I mentioned that Brown did make a commitment that she seems to have kept to restore the process of making sure that a person in the community can actually individually talk on an agenda item without having all his time crunched into 2 minutes for all 20 consent agenda items as one object. And unfortunately, she didn't do that as an institutional change, as has been requested, and I think that may be on Glover's to-do list. At least he says it is, and we'll see if it is in actuality. But she never did that, and I think there are many ways city council members can expose to the community the corrupt or apparently colluding workings of the staff who really run the city, as I say again and again. And to do that requires making explicit requests of the staff and documenting when they don't do it. And you do that and then you create the paper trail, and then the citizenry, the community anyway, gets to see what's going on. And that's something I've never been able to get Brown to do in any consistent way. And I don't know whether it's because she has a personal antipathy to me, whether she has a disability, whether she's sick all the time, whether she's... I can make up all kinds of excuses, but it really boils down to the fact that she's either incompetent or has made an unprincipled decision to not only go back on her word, but to repeat lies that she's going to do things and then not do them. And she doesn't want to face this. And I don't know, you know, I mean, I met with her. I sat down with her we had a confrontation with Justin Cummings. A bunch of us did that a couple of weeks ago, the Monday before the Tuesday vote when Cummings voted to kill the Ross Kemp. We wanted to talk him, everybody at the meeting except him, which wanted to persuade him to stay the course until there was adequate shelter, as he had voted for before. But he had the strangest excuses that I've talked about in past shows, that he wanted to make the staff accountable by showing that there was no shelter when everybody got evicted, that would be the way to really show how bad the staff was. He needed to... This he didn't talk about much, but it seemed to be one of the principal motivations. I don't know whether I got this through secondhand gossip or simply speculating myself, or whether it was explicitly stated by someone who was a friend of his or a confidant, that he is part of this 2x2 committee with the city's by the county, and that includes him, Watkins, and two supervisors, and they said they would not vote for funding for 1220 River unless the Ross Kemp was closed. And the Ross Kemp, and so he agreed to sacrifice the lives of all these people. I don't mean their physical life, but their security, their housing, everything else, with the excuse that this was because they needed better. The same pretext I heard people defending the camping ban and the sleeping ban sections of the camping ban way back in 1988, when you had a so-called progressive majority on city council. John Laird, Marty Wormhout, Jane Yokoyama was elected, Don Lane, and they all said they were supporting Yama, who actually said, sleeping outside isn't good enough for people. If we allow them to sleep outside, we're selling them out. And so she allowed the police to harass them, arrest them, ticket them, and abuse them, steal their property for decade after decade after that. I think she died within a decade or less afterward. So she didn't last long. But there's a reason I called her Jane Hokey Mama. And there's, I think, often good reason to... very severely lampoon the pretensions of these chair-warming politicians who have the power to change things but choose not to do so. Keith McHenry and his description of Ross Camp on Bruce Bratton's show.
Knowing that it would bring out huge anti-homeless resistance, mm-hmm. and which it did, mm-hmm. and then people attacked Drew for that. That was not Drew's proposal. He ended up having to vote for it because everything else that happened was subverted by the rest of the council and by city staff. Mm-hmm. And so now we're in this an even larger crisis. On Saturday and Sunday, the anxiety and the people are so disturbed and acting out and having trouble emotionally because of this. And that's what we saw when they closed the emergency shelter on Coral Street, mm-hmm. which then inspired the Freedom Sleepers. We saw that when they closed the River Street camp, when they closed the benchlands.
When Keith talks about closing the emergency shelter, to at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, as I call the homeless, what they call the Homeless Services Center on Coral Street, was the action taken under Phil Kramer, who is still the executive director there, which was to insist on a pathway to housing, which means essentially some kind of funding that you've got to bring with you before you can even get into the emergency shelter in the Paul Lee Loft. Now, my somewhat uncertain understanding at the moment is that they've abandoned this. This was what one of the workers there told me about 6 months ago, back to the, because there's now an emphasis again on emergency shelter and they're getting funding for it. But in 2015, they abandoned Paul Lee Loft, and they may have done it even before then, as an emergency shelter. And it became a place where you had to have a whole series of qualifications to get it, mostly financial or some kind of government checks or something to that effect of Section 8. And there, they would hold you there briefly as supposedly the transitional phase. And you see this big placard along the highway which says 750 people housed. But if you ask them specifically for particulars on how many people, what kind of housing they got, whether they're still in the housing, how permanent it was, whether it involved subsidies that they had to use and they would have been using anyway, and what the inflow of cash compared to the outflow of housing was, you don't get any answers at all. I've asked repeatedly for the budget of the Homeless Lack of Services Center from Kramer and from his underlings, who come on very friendly, but then suddenly, they can't give you any information, and they don't want to tell you who's blocking it, which to me is just as important as not getting the information, and that's why I suggest people like Sandy Brown need to ask written questions of the police chief, written questions of the head of Parks and Rec, written questions of the city manager, and maybe she'll start doing this now that we're starting to see public interest groups forming. Like today, I went to the first meeting, I think it was the first meeting at the Tabby Cat Cafe, which is kind of a new meeting spot, I guess, where lefties get together. And I sat in a meeting chaired by Elise, who's really severely pissed, and properly so, at the city council's behavior about the kind of machinations that Mayor Watkins and City Manager Martine Burnell use to keep items off the agenda. There are sort of new groups and new developments happening in Santa Cruz. I'm always skeptical of this, and you're going to hear my conversation with activist Phil Posner, who had a conversation with Captain Harold, who runs this, he's the boss of the local Salvation Army shelters. That's 7th Avenue Shelter, Laurel Street Shelter, and the River Street Campground at 1220 River Street. Phil is ever hopeful that people will respond to the realities of suffering outside and of suffering people and see reason and come to compromises. And I don't deny that these things can happen, but I believe them when they do happen and not when they're promised or that one should hold back on the pressure in the hope that they're going to happen, which I think is a snare and a delusion. Or back to, and we will be finishing this soon, this discussion between Bruce Bratton, who I think he still writes a regular column for the Good Times, and Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bombs, and not just someone who's resting on his laurels, but is constantly active around not just providing food for people as a charity and vegetarian for folks as a veganism, I guess you would call it, to have folks be aware of the incredible impact that the slaughter of animals has on the environment. But he's also out there pitching for homeless people locally. So, yeah, I like it. Keep it up, Keith.
Every time there's this massive disruption in people's lives, you see people suffering, and it's just outrageous.
Let me take another break. Tell everybody you're listening to Universe of Grapevine. I'm Bruce Bratton, and my guest right now, Keith McHenry, will be back with him in a second. After I tell you, KZSC thanks Owl Family Properties for helping local community radio and this program. Owl Family Properties
will do an exposure of Owl and Barry Swenson and other big developers around town who really need to get a little serious analysis and criticism. And I'd like to have people on who have information on those issues, so please give me a call at the HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom line at 423-HUFF or 423-4833.
Tell us about what people can do, where they can stay up to date on what's happening, and who they should contact, and who, where they can work.
Well, I think probably the best way to get on the ground details right now is to show up at the Food Not Bombs meal on at the downtown post office from 4 to 6 on Saturday and Sunday.
Actually, the best way is to talk to homeless people directly and to go see, you know, walk around and talk to real human beings on the street, who are in tents and camps and curled up in sleeping bags and so forth. And, you know, you don't have to be a charity giver to do that. You can just be an ordinary person saying, hey, what's going on? You know, or, you know, and they might tell you to fuck off, or they might, you know, be glad to have someone to talk to most, or might just be interested in, if you're interested, they might be interested too. But, you know, Food Not Bombs is an okay place to go, too. There's a lot of homeless people who go there, and a lot of people who have associations with homeless people from 4 to 6 every Saturday and Sunday.
As our flyers?
We have flyers. We often have...
About Camp Ross or about the future?
About what's really happening.
Yeah, okay.
So that's where you could go to Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
And there I post like from all the other efforts that are going on surrounding the attacks on people living outside and possible solutions, information there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they could call me at 1-800-884-1136, and you can get that number at foodnotbombs.net and find out more details. And then we have a meeting every Thursday at Tabby Cat at 3 o'clock to discuss the progress of Food Not Bombs. And then,
so that would be a place where people could interact with you and tell you what they could do to help.
Correct.
You out.
And then our probably our...
And there may be actually another meeting of Elisa's group to kind of monitor the city council at 1 o'clock on Thursday. So you could probably go at 1 and hang out for Keith's meeting, too, at 3, if there's a repeated meeting. And I'll try to find out later in this broadcast if she's going to do another meeting. It was seemed like quite a successful meeting today, because I went to part of it anyway and had to kind of hustle back here to do the show. But, yeah, I mean, worth checking out.
The most important meeting is Wednesdays, tomorrow, at 11 o'clock at Sub Rosa, at, you know, behind Saturn Cafe on you know, on Pacific Avenue. Mm-hmm. And there, mm-hmm. that's where we make a lot of our decisions of what, where we as a community support are going to do. And we're talking about, I mean, the lawsuit still continues to this day. That's, we're collecting a lot of evidence showing that the city did not actually provide housing and shelter for the people, all the people at Ross Camp. And that will continue. And of course, in July, we will have this additional huge number of people, 60 people, enter the streets, and there will be more.
Because in July, the both, I think it's both shelter programs, 7th Avenue and Laurel, and I think it's 7th Avenue for sure, and it's also the River Street Camp ends, and so that means the maybe at max 150 people, though. Brent Adams made a big point of saying, well, not many people are using these shelter programs for whatever reason, and therefore, if people really want to get in, they can. So there really is shelter available, and therefore activists who are claiming that there's no shelter available are misleading the community. And my response to that, and actually I just sort of quickly raise my defensive shield here, or at least clarify, is that Brent Adams would agree with me that have no business going after people on the street or providing their own shelter, given the fact that even if every person who could went into the shelters that are available, and that's probably no more than shelter for 200 people, it would still leave the overwhelming majority, as I always say, of 1,000 to 2,000 people out there without shelter. And those people are facing criminalization by the police. Comments made by Chief Andy Mills, misleading comments about not enforcing the sleeping sections of the camping ban or the camping ban generally, because instead other laws such as no trespassing on public property, and I'm talking about private property, but public property, being in a closed area after dark, and this Parks and Rec has closed off many areas, whether it's the area around the library, the area around the police station, the area around the City Hall grounds, all of which used to be open and you would think would be a place where people could go, if not to sleep, at least to sit with a sign if you're opposed to government policies. As I perennially repeat, it is outrageous that they're doing this, and it is a true tribute to the kind of corruption that's going on in our, not just our government, but in our community, that we allow this to continue. Of course, allowing the Trump administration and the Obama administration before it to continue murdering populations abroad in our name, and allowing our city government to continue to, in its own different ways, endorse this. And you say, well, how are they endorsing it? And my answer has always been, well, let's look in carefully into the investments the city makes and make sure they're not investing in war economies. Make sure they're not investing in BDS movement, I should say, as what they characterize as what needs to be opposed. That's a boycott, divestment, and sanction movement against the Israeli occupation governments in the West Bank and elsewhere. Former council member Tim Fitzmaurice, who I've repeatedly asked to, when he was on the council, to do a study or have the staff look into the study of the actual investments of the city, has never been done. Or if it's been done, I've never heard about it. And who knows? We have people like Glover who are interested in that sort of thing, but they're fending off attacks from all sides by phony baloney disciplinarian school teachers like Maxine Watkins, Martine Watkins, who are accusing Glover of sexism and bullying when, you know, it's ironic that the bullying is going on from the centers of power that are now fighting fiercely to maintain their center, in this case being Watkins, Bernal, Condotti, Myers, and of course, the Queen Bee, Cynthia Matthews.
That we'll have. We're already taking evidence from the people that have had to leave the Motel Santa Cruz already. Where are they going? So we need documentation and videotaping and audio tapes of depositions of people living out on the streets and what happened to their belongings when they were evicted from Ross Camp. What
happened to, have they been attacked and sexually assaulted, as was the case happening to many women before Ross Camp?
And indeed, not just do we need declarations, we need people helping to get these declarations, people helping to establish connections between current encampments. Ross Camp scattered all over the city. You have people outside who are on this section of the sidewalk or that. There aren't really significant, I've not heard of significant numbers of people gathering in one place or another actually happening right now in this week after the dispersal of the Ross Camp. Concerned about homeless civil rights, the California Homeless Union is raising its standard in Santa Cruz. Anthony Prince will be talking about the lawsuit in front of the 1220 River Street at 11 o'clock on Monday. That'll be on Monday, the 13th, the day before the shitty council meeting that will be happening sometime on that day. We don't have a day yet. I mean, we have a day. We don't have an hour yet for that. That agenda usually comes out Thursday night. I'm told it's being prepared for Friday, strangely enough, and they are not legally required to have it posted until 3 days or 72 hours before the actual meeting, which is usually, around early afternoon on Tuesday. So early afternoon on Friday is where they actually are legally required to post the agenda. That was one of the things we talked about at this meeting run by Elise, who is concerned with holding the city council accountable and stopping it from the kind of reactionary backroom strangulation of measures that restore human rights and human services in Santa Cruz. We'll be appearing at 11 o'clock on the 13th in front of 1220 River Street. If you come a little early, we're going to also be some other speakers. I think we're inviting Chief Mills to come as well. We're inviting, Captain Harold of the Salvation Army, who you're going to hear Phil Posner talk about later in this broadcast. We went up there and we were blocked from going in. Myself, Phil Posner of Conscience in Action, and Alicia Kuhl, who's the liaison for the Ross Camp Council, trying to reach some of the plaintiffs in this lawsuit that Keith is talking about, trying to document the abuses against the homeless people who are being evicted from Ross Camp. But really, by extension, it's homeless people all over the city who are facing this kind of persecution, this kind of regular seizure of their property, regular move along, but we haven't got any place for you to go, just get the hell out of here, because the neighbor doesn't like you being here, because somebody called in a complaint that you were doing this or that, even though they aren't willing to say who they are, even though you can't really defend yourself from that kind of anonymous charge. Don't park here in your van. Don't park here in your car and try to sleep here. This kind of essentially blanket denial of basic human rights in Santa Cruz has been a longtime feature of the city, but now it's becoming more overt and more open. And at the same time, of course, it's getting masked by these phony stories of shelter that only the shelter resistant are denying. Oh, people really have all these options. If only they just did them. Oh, if they could just drop right into this drug abuse program and everything would be just fine. This is the kind of misleading narrative that helps to stoke people's sense that people outside are less than human.
Is there more violence by Take Back Santa Cruz against people living outside? What exactly is going on with this crisis? So the city spent a lot of money setting up a temporary camp at Benchlands, of which I think at the height had 30 people. It lasted like less than a week. Mm-hmm. Massive amount of expense on tents and all kinds of resources. And it turned out that it was, many people just didn't want to be like one in a fishbowl where everybody's looking at them, two have to go through all the security. And I think, quite frankly, that the people that are in the city that are making these decisions have not, first of all, ever been homeless. So they have no idea about the logistics of being homeless, and they just don't get that they don't have calendars and ID and all this stuff that they would anticipate people to have if you were housed.
Thank you. We're out of time.
Wow, again. That was fast.
Yeah. No, well, you got
from an album, Songs of Protest and Anti-Protest, by Bobby Jameson way back in 1965, who I've never heard of before. I believe it was known by a different name in England, but probably hear a few more from him later in the show. Story for Santa Cruz to consider. It's in the Mercury News from May 6th. San Francisco and Oakland consider ban on facial recognition. They would be the first cities in the nation to have such a law, by Leva Semagayase. San Francisco could become the first city in the nation to ban any city department from using facial recognition under a proposal that says any benefits of the technology outweigh its impact on civil rights, and Oakland may not be far behind. San Francisco Board of Supervisors Committee is scheduled to vote today, and apparently may have already voted, on the Stop Secret Surveillance Ordinance, which would make it illegal for any department to, quote, obtain, retain, access, or use any face recognition technology or information obtained from such technology. The proposal, introduced by San Francisco Supervisor Aaron Peskin in January, also would require public input and the supervisor's approval before agencies buy surveillance technology with public funds. That includes the purchase of license plate readers, toll readers, closed-circuit cameras, body cams, biometrics technology, and software for forecasting criminal activity. Some of this Santa Cruz already has, thanks to that pioneer in Snoopology, Zach Friend, who made it all the way from a police department PR all the way up to the Board of Supervisors. A nice climb, and who knows, he may climb even further. Brim for his phony denunciations of homeless protests way back in 2007 in our Homies for the Homeless protest at City Hall, which he smeared as a thesis-ridden area, when in fact, of course, it was the city council and the city manager of that day who closed the bathrooms at City Hall, as they did again 8 years later, to again make protesting stinkier. I guess that's their plan. If it smells more, then city people will blame it on the protesters rather than on those who are shutting down the facilities. Continuing with the story, the propensity for facial recognition technology to endanger civil rights and civil liberties substantially outweighs its purported benefits, and the technology will exacerbate racial injustice and threaten our ability to live free of continuous government monitoring, the ordinance reads. Various cities and counties, including Berkeley, Palo Alto, and Santa Clara County, have similar rules in place about buying surveillance tech, but a San Francisco ban on facial recognition would set a precedent. In Oakland, a proposal to add a ban on facial recognition to city regulations about surveillance tech is set to be considered by Oakland's Public Safety Committee later this month. However, as far as I know, no such examination is happening in Santa Cruz, nor is there any Public Records Act to determine exactly how much surveillance activity, and or even just getting to the one particular part of it, the facial recognition technology, is actually in place or being contemplated, planned, or sought. Requests that the city outline exactly where in public places standard surveillance devices are monitoring them, how much it cost, when they were put in, how often these surveillance tapes or records are destroyed, has all been ignored, or even simply clearly mendaciously denied, that is to say, denied in the face of the truth, which is obviously there are surveillance devices in all kinds of places. Most obvious is in the police station. That's a public place as you walk in. Even that surveillance technology, which was requested as a public record, was not acknowledged as even being there. We have a truly not just unresponsive government, not just a government that ignores the rights and needs of poor people or of the citizenry generally or favors the rich. We have a government bureaucracy that is self-perpetuating and self-defending and doesn't mind lying about the most obvious things, even those that are where a lie is clearly a lie. This is sort of part of the whole strategy and technology around the Roskamp closing. They don't really care. And even taking it to court doesn't seem to do any good at the federal level so far. Nonetheless, we continue. Continuing with the story. Brian Hoffer, chairman of the Oakland Privacy Advisory Commission, who has helped draft ordinances around the Bay Area, said that as far as he knows, facial recognition isn't being used by police in the area. That's the reason we're trying to prevent that now, said Hoffer, who has filed suit against the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Office, the San Jose Police Department, and others, after he said he was pulled over last year and handcuffed with guns pointed at him when the license plate reader mistakenly identified the rental car he was driving as stolen. The genie is not out of the bottle yet. But the ACLU, which helped draft the ordinances, pointed out that deploying facial recognition would be easy enough. The raw materials for face surveillance, data such as mugshots and video feeds from CCT and body cams, already exist, said Matt Cagle, technology and civil liberties expert with the ACLU of Northern California. With just a few lines of code, existing photo systems can be turned into dangerous dragnet surveillance network. The proposed ordinance came after high-profile examples of the pitfalls of facial recognition, including a report last year that Amazon's recognition software falsely matched the faces of members of Congress with mugshots of people who had been arrested. Now, that sounds actually like not really much of a mistake. The San Francisco Police Department, which said it doesn't use facial recognition, submitted amendments to the ordinance after talking with other city departments, community groups, neighborhood watch groups, and businesses. Our mission must be judiciously balanced with the need to protect civil rights and civil liberties, including privacy and free expression, said David Stevenson, spokesman for the San Francisco Police Department. We welcome safeguards to protect those rights. And I have a bridge I can sell you over in Brooklyn. While balancing the needs that protect the residents, visitors, and businesses of San Francisco. Lee Heppner, legislative aide to Piskun, said the supervisor's office incorporated some of the SFPD's requests into the ordinance. If it is approved in committee today, the full board will vote May 14th. Same day as the Santa Cruz City Council meeting. Over time, this will build a lot of trust among the community and the police, Heppner said. Hopefully, in the end, it will be a win-win. Cisco Sheriff's Department spokeswoman Nancy Crowley said the department does not use facial recognition. She added that most of the agency's work is in non-public spaces, but if the ordinance is passed, we will comply with the requirements that impact our work. The Oakland Police Department did not return a request for comment. Color of Change, a national nonprofit racial justice advocacy group founded in Oakland, supports both ordinances. This is an important moment for San Francisco, said Brandy Collins-Dexter, senior campaign director for the group. She said the city is positioned to really protect its constituents and could influence others, Santa Cruz perhaps, around the nation. In a letter urging supervisors to pass the ordinance, Color of Change expressed concern about high-tech profiling. The group cited a 2009 incident in which multiple San Francisco police officers pointed their guns at a black woman who was pulled over based on mistaken information from a license plate reader, that the car she was driving was stolen. The woman, Denise Green, a former Muni driver, settled her lawsuit against San Francisco in 2015 for $495,000. Nowadays, Collins-Dexter says, police have access to technologies the likes of which we've never seen. AI experts in April urged Amazon to stop selling facial recognition software to law enforcement until safeguards and laws are put into place. Its technology is now being tested by police in Oregon. Amazon shareholders are scheduled to vote this month on a shareholder resolution urging Amazon to stop selling Recognition. That's the name, I guess, of its recognition technology. The companies that make the technologies also have called for limits and regulations. Microsoft, late last year, called for regulating artificial intelligence, and Amazon followed suit earlier this year. In addition, the Partnership on AI, whose members include Facebook, Google, Amazon.com, Apple, Microsoft, IBM, and academic researchers, said last week that law enforcement should not use artificial intelligence algorithms to make decisions about jailing people. Meanwhile, some Bay Area law enforcement agencies, including Santa Cruz and UC Berkeley, have been using predictive policing technology. So has Santa Cruz. They started it here, actually. Thank you, Zach. Others, such as Mountain View's and Palo Alto's police departments, tried such technology, but decided not to continue its use. That's an article in the May 6th Mercury News, San Francisco and Oakland consider ban on facial recognition.
To that I know nothing woman.
Lisa.
And Lisa, we're here at the Food Now Bombs table on May 4th, about 10 after 5. Why are you at this table, and what the heck are you doing?
I need to educate myself about how to best support people on the streets.
And how long you've been in Santa Cruz?
Since 84.
And how long you've been interested in people on the street?
Oh, well, actively, apologetically, 5 weeks.
What got you interested?
Wanting to do social action, wanting to be connected with people in my community in need.
Anything particular incident spark this? A dream?
I was pleased when I saw the encampment at Ross, and I was excited that people that were on the streets had community. And so I wanted to get more involved seeing that camp.
And what originally got you over to Ross? Did you know people there? Did you decide you wanted to crash for the night? What happened?
No, I am a house person, but I discovered Food Not Bombs shortly after the camp started and started volunteering with Food Not Bombs.
And you've been coming to Food Not Bombs with some regularity?
Weekly now, yeah, for 5 weeks.
How has your perspective on things changed, if it has at all?
I just very much appreciate meeting the people here on the streets and the activists working to support them. So I am just appreciating the community. It's not a changed perspective, but it's a more informed perspective.
Anything happened today that I should know about at this Food Not Bombs meal since I just got here?
Oh, well, yesterday the camp closed, so I kind of expected maybe there'd be more people here, but maybe it's the first of the month and they have more money, so it's kind of a mellow, nice afternoon and people are enjoying the food.
And it's not too hot yet.
No. Yeah. Okay.
That's what I got. Anything else you want to volunteer?
No, thank you for your interview.
And we've been talking with
Lisa Ward.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks.
May 5th, the day after the closing of the Ross camp. May 4th. It was a Saturday. Sorry. Police closed and fenced off the area, though not giving people any alternate place to go with any kind of assurance or clarity. On the 3rd, they then fenced off the area over the weekend, would not allow people in, and on the 6th, on Monday, they opened up the area, they said, between 9 and 12. I only got there late, around 11:15, 11:30, and saw, well, a little of this and a little of that, and here are some of my reports.
Of people out here supposedly cleaning up the area. Folks are wearing masks. We have a bulldozer trashing and throwing bicycle parts and bicycles into a large dumpster. I'm counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 cops and guys in yellow hazmat suits. I'm outside the camp. And we have at least one person inside the camp who is picking up clothing while being observed by it looks like a ranger in brown. And we have at least another dozen people inside working on destroying and discarding people's property. I don't see any attempt to save any of it. There's no vehicle that I can see that involves any kind of property being saved. So I think people are simply trying to have everything bulldozed. That's a likely situation. We also...
And the... The critical point here and the basis for a lawsuit afterward is that the city had no alternative place for people to go after destroying their homes. They had the option to provide these places. City has plenty of vacant spaces. City has resources to set up camps. City has transportation devices that would allow that. And it's conceivable that they could have done this, but they didn't. And instead, they simply destroyed people's shelter and then the great majority of their property. You might say, well, it's just their tarps and their tents and their bedding and all that stuff is used, and maybe it's all filthy and drug-ridden and vice-ridden and lice-ridden. And when it's cold at night, you need to be covered with a blanket. And the notion that the city made no offer to supply 200 people with blankets, made no offer to supply 200 people with tents. They supplied a handful of people with tents who went to the 30 people with tents who went to the border, to the San Lorenzo Benchlands area. And then they set up those same small one-person tents over at the 1220 River Street. But they didn't provide anybody with tents. And at the same time, they were destroying tents. And doing so, quite possibly, having really put people in a position where they were telling them to get out or else face arrest, get out or face harassment, get out or face maybe even assault. They didn't say these things. But that's the implication when you have armed police telling you, get out by 10 o'clock. Or I think originally it was get out by 9 or 10 o'clock on Friday. And then it was, oh, he can stay in the day, but you've got to get out by sundown. And it was really around sundown everybody was forced out of the camp. But people didn't have time to take their stuff. Or any place to take it to.
Have an overcast sky, and very few people are here. Of course, I'm here late, and the time is 20 to 12, which is 20 minutes until the closing time. Very few people are here. Hello again. Yeah, you don't say.
I also was told that people would not be let in, this is some days before, unless they had signed up on a list specifically. And that meant a lot of people who left in the tumult couldn't get back in, although I didn't talk to any, I got no particular accounts from those people, and hopefully I will be seeking that information later to pass on to those who are filing lawsuits.
Thanks for the friendliness. That's what we like from public employees. Hi.
It was an unresponsive, I think it was a police officer or a CSO or possibly a ranger. It might have been also a city worker of some other kind, declining to answer a question or respond to a normal hello. This happened right before this little bit of audio you're about to hear.
Oh, yeah. It's the season. So I'm down here at the parking lot in front of Ross, looking over the large number of ranger vehicles, police cars, first alarm. Actually, not so many. But a lot of the parking spaces are taken up with either these A-frame blockers. We've actually got a porta potty down here. And folks are, well, there are fences up. The sky is overcast. And here comes Maggie and Serge. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Any quick reports on what's going on?
No.
Many people showing up to pick up their stuff?
Quite a few. Yeah.
How many would you estimate?
Well, I haven't been here that long.
I think it's 11 out of 30.
Are they letting people in who say that they want their stuff but who haven't are not on Mill's list?
I got a couple people added to the list.
Good for you.
But
but he's trying to make sure that people don't just walk in and steal people's stuff too.
Right, right. So,
I mean, before they dump everything, are they going to? Are they going? What are they going to do? They find it. They're going to dump, or they're going to actually confiscate and hold for 90 days.
They're doing the dumping section now.
Oh, they are.
Yeah. Fire is in there doing hazmatish stuff. They're the ones walking around in the Tyvek suits.
Is anybody? Is any media?
Yeah, they're there too. Uh-huh.
Are they videoing this stuff? So that
some of it.
Any activists documenting?
I was here, but I don't think he's here anymore.
Okay.
The vouchers I heard were just from Friday for 2 days, and with a promise of more. But that leaves you at Sunday morning,
right?
So people didn't have motel vouchers.
I heard you had problems with that.
And he's talking about vouchers to motels for those who couldn't get into 1220 River Street, 7th Avenue, or the Laurel Street shelter.
And actually, I am going to plot my...
Susie slept late. I mean, that can happen. You know?
She was here before, but she wasn't going to be coming on Sunday. Like,
well, you know, you can only carry things so far.
And I'm being sarcastically referencing Susie O'Hara, the assistant city manager, who spread so much of this misinformation over the last, well, actually over the last 7 or 8 years, but because she's been on a lot of these... She's been a key person in a lot of these city council anti-homeless task forces and groups that have been proposing anti-homeless legislation and then providing misleading statistics about housing and shelter.
They promised in 4 to be 5 days with addition, not 2.
Well, you got to change your mind every now and then.
Well, they were here earlier, and my young friend who had, like, 3 carloads of stuff, which
right.
I helped remove to their hotel room, are in the hotel room Sunday morning, and she's been promised an additional voucher, and, you know, no arrangements had been made for how she was going to get that voucher. And yesterday, I helped her move the things. Well, a lot of it's still in my car. I had a hard time sleeping last night because all the stuff in my car.
Sorry, my bad. Yeah.
But I helped them move their things.
Very true.
But she came here this morning and got a voucher. So.
5 days?
Yeah. One of those days was yesterday.
I see. So. Did you stay outside last night? Where did you stay?
I'd rather not say.
But generally speaking?
Not a safe place.
So.
It involves crossing the freeway on foot.
Oh, I heard about that. The island, so to speak.
Yes.
I didn't even know where
she
that is.
I offered to help her carry things over there. She said, no, Maggie, I'm not going to let you do that.
I see. She wanted to protect you.
Yes. Yep. And I called Philip about this, because if we're talking about irreparable harm, if Kelly gets squashed on the freeway walking to her safe place to sleep, that is irreparable harm.
Philip being?
The lawyer.
Oh, Anthony.
Anthony, sorry. Yeah. And so we talked about that. We're going to talk again today.
Want to help fill out a declaration?
I have to go first to the bathroom.
Indeed. Are the porta-potties are no more.
No. Yeah, I have to go someplace. No, I've got to meet Kelly to help with some stuff.
And we've been talking with?
Maggie Rochelle.
Thank you, Maggie.
A.K.A. Sam's mom. A.K.A. Mom.
Number of A.K.A.s.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And what may be a minor point, but is this going to be a smelly one? The 8 to 10 porta-potties, I guess it was 8 porta-potties. I thought there were more at points, but then there were 2 or 3 or 4 wash stations. The Sharps containers are all gone, and they aren't being replaced anywhere else, as far as I know. At least I haven't heard that's happened. So all the same people are going to be all around town doing their business where they have to and facing, leaving it where they do. Thank you, Martine Bernal. Thank you, Susie O'Hara. Thank you, Tina Scholl. Justin Cummings.
Here at the folks trying to help people save their property from the Ross camp, toting stuff in barrels and boxes and tote.
You're gnarly.
Thank you.
You're pretty sharp, man.
And you guys are telling me that they aren't saving the property that's valuable. But
yeah, no, absolutely not.
And how many hours have you been out here moving this stuff?
We just started actually helping a friend of mine and probably about an hour or so.
Some hazmat guy coming out said that they hadn't been doing it, but up to now, then they're going to go through later and pick up people's papers and so forth.
I don't know about all that. Yeah. Honest to God's truth, what I've been seeing, yes, and I'm here every day, is they're probably going to come in with some kind of dozer, scrape it all into one big pile, and toss it in the dumpsters. Believe me.
And that apparently is what we saw in the days that followed. It wasn't just apparently. That was what my eyes told me as I went down there. I guess it was the next day or the day after.
I have a bulldozer up there now. He was telling me that you guys...
I don't see them hand-picking out anything like that. No, no, sir.
And you, what part of the camp were you in? The part near?
Well, I wasn't part of this. I know friends. I got friends that are here, so I come down and make sure, you know, everything's smooth with them and stuff like that. Yeah.
Now, what's your first name?
John.
I'm Robert, John.
All right, Robert.
And have you been in the camp, too?
No, I haven't.
You've been out here helping to load stuff.
Actually, I just came to go to the bank. I live in an apartment over here. I'm one of the lucky ones.
Yeah, right.
Right, and true.
And I did my time out here, though.
Yeah.
I guess so. A lot of people will be doing their time after you. So.
It's a way to look at it, you know?
It's a hard town to find a place in. Yeah.
So I see you have a truck almost filled with, what do we call these guys?
Tubs, like Tupperware tubs, durable ones, Huskies maybe. Yeah, they're here on the, but yeah, they're really good. And they have holes drilled on the side, you know, by the factory where you could put a padlock in there or something like that. Not saying it's going to deter people, but it'll slow them down.
Now, is this one person's stuff or is this a number of people's stuff?
Tell you the truth, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
And these were tubs full of property that they were hauling away before the final gates were closed, and they just, well, the city began to destroy everything inside that people had collected or made a part of their homes over the last 6 months. Now, it's possible that some of this stuff was being taken by these folks said they lived nearby, and they were, I guess one of them gave the impression he was housed. Somebody suggested, well, maybe these people are stealing this stuff, and that could be true, too, although that wasn't the impression I got. But the city is what put this, if it is a theft operation, that facilitated it. And what it really was, of course, was a massive seizure of homeless property in the most callous and cruel way of the most basic kind of survival property.
Nor do I.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Keep up the good work, guys.
Help my buddy get it in.
There you go. Yeah.
There
could be a dispute between the hazmat person who I spoke with, but I didn't get him on audio here, and the individuals we just heard who are helping to load, presumably, and hopefully they're loading and not thieving. You never can tell what the hell's going on around here. Because the hazmat guy said he had been involved since 8 o'clock in picking up needles, and he was now just beginning, bringing a tub up to take out valuable property like papers, social security cards, and so forth. But I asked him if he'd actually seen any of this done. He said no, because he'd been involved in this other needle disposal and pickup. So the entrance was kind of blocked. I did not attempt to get in, although, again, we were about 10 or 20 minutes from the...
Media people were in there with big cameras. I think it was Phil Gomez and the guy, the big husky guy with the big, big camera inside taking footage.
And this is Gloria Rove, who's also been very active in videoing and discussing and reporting on what's going on at Ross Camp. He's a regular attender of the Huff and Conscience in Action meetings.
Right.
Why were they allowed in?
Oh, they're fancy media. And I suppose, you know, I did get here late, and I spent a lot of my time, most of my time, getting declarations, three declarations from people. So that's what happened there. Did you see anything, Gloria?
I saw people going through their stuff. I saw tents being collapsed. I couldn't tell where they were, how they were deciding what was trash and what was not. They were letting people in to claim their stuff, but...
Did they require people to be on a list to reclaim their stuff?
I couldn't tell. I wasn't close enough to hear everything, but I'm thinking they're probably eager to get this done. They look like they're in a plague zone with all those masks and gloves and, you know, practically hazmat suits. It's sad. And there are people scrambling for their belongings.
How many people, and I know you got here like only half an hour before closing, but how many people would you say were in there who are either the residents or friends of the residents trying to help the people move their stuff out before it gets closed forever?
I couldn't get a head count because it's hard to see in there, but at least I would say a dozen who weren't wearing their, you know, the protective gear and didn't look official. And, you know, a woman was going through her stuff and chatting over the fence to another gal. They went down the bank, the cops did, with caution to approach the gal with the orangish hair. I don't think you got a chance to talk to her, but she was sitting down kind of halfway covered with bushes near the river, and they went down and they talked to her, and she came back up. Now, I talked to her just a little bit. I gave her some water.
You can't tell whether they directed her to move?
I couldn't tell. She didn't look unhappy. I was looking for that, if she was feeling impressed. Mm-hmm. I think she just wanted to get away from it all.
And we've been talking with
Gloria.
Thank you, Gloria. So I'm out.
Thank you.
There's another by Chris Lucy, Songs of Protest and Anti-Protest. I can't tell you the name of the song, sorry. Now we move to a confrontation that happened in front of the 1220 River Street and led yesterday to a decision by Conscience in Action and Huff to hold a press conference in front of the 1220 River Street camp about the issue of accessibility to the camp, but also the broader issue of the lack of, not just the lack of shelter, the abusive treatment of homeless people and the need to stop it, and for the need for homeless people to come together and unite in demanding it be stopped and forming chains of solidarity with each other, which is really, in my mind, the only way that this ever really gets stopped. We were attempting to visit the Ross camp because Alicia Cole had some Ross camp liaisons type business to conduct with two of the people who lived, she was pretty sure, inside, I don't mean the Ross camp, I keep saying Ross camp, but inside the River Street camp that the Ross camp had been, some people in the Ross camp had been sent to. In front of the River Street camp was a guard, the same guard who had harassed Alicia, this was her claim anyway, when she parked at the Ross camp area in the parking lot next to the Ross store. And the guard, according to Alicia, had repeatedly called the police on her, claiming she was selling drugs when she was bringing in water to people in the Ross camp. She was never ticketed or otherwise cited or arrested by police. Anyway, here's that confrontation. I was with her along with activist Phil Posner.
They're located in here.
Okay, so no one's allowed to enter here, but let me go get the staff. One of them. I don't know who's here.
Okay. Right, we're also here to find out if people can have visitors.
As long as they sign in and
things like that.
And you're hearing the voices of Alicia Cool, Phil Posner, myself, and the security guard, and then eventually director, a fellow named, well, I think he names himself, hopefully, and we'll catch that.
So, we're here at the gate. City property authorized entry only. Unauthorized entry is prohibited. We've talked to Jeff, one of the security guards. Pleasant weather. It's about 5 to 11 on May 5th, and I'm looking in
for a rush.
That's what I hear.
Yeah,
I mean, that seems to be the case.
How many tents did you say that they have here?
Jeff, how many tents? How many
You're
tents?
Have to go talk to Captain Harris for that.
How do we get a hold of Captain Harris? He's not on site?
No. We're not accepting that. We're going in.
You're not allowed to.
Well, then you're going to have to call the police and arrest us.
You're not allowed to enter.
You're going to have to call the police and arrest us. Look at show them.
I don't know. That's my job is to do this.
Okay, call the police.
Captain Harold?
I don't have his number. I don't know who he is.
If you're managing this facility, you have to be able to contact the director.
Look, ma'am, I don't have the questions for that.
I think they'll arrive here
front and not let anybody in.
So who's in charge here?
You just served.
So I'm calling the police right now.
Okay. You just went and asked somebody, right? What did they tell you?
I'm just going to call the police.
Okay. So take a picture of me getting arrested.
Well, you're not going to get arrested. You haven't done anything.
Well, I'm going in.
No, you're not. Hi, I'm with First Alarm. I'm over here at the bench lines at 1220 River Street.
Of course, he's not at the bench lands. He's at 1220 River Street. He's a little rattled. Again, this is the guy who was, according to Alicia, in conflict with him before. So maybe that had something to do with his nervousness. He didn't seem willing to get... I'm not sure if he got in touch with people inside or they finally came over, but the three of us were waiting outside this red fence, which was topped with barbed wire.
Oh, I have all the lawsuit paperwork.
It wasn't the lawsuit.
Yeah.
Hi there. So are you the person managing this place?
Are you recording this, please?
Yep.
Please don't record me. I'm more than happy to talk to you.
Okay.
I'm very happy to talk to you.
And it's nothing personal, but he's calling the police, so we need a record of what's going on. So.
Oh.
Yeah, he's calling the police on us, even though we're just standing here.
Morning, Lauren.
Questions.
Right. I just want to write down.
How often is it? So, when people were displaced, they were guaranteed alternatives.
It was for a couple of days. It was
right. And
they
are calling the police on us, even though we're.
And there's a bit of jumping around here. I'm sorry. We're going to get back to the chronology. Here we go.
Morning, Laura.
Questions.
And also another woman, an African-American woman, Lauren Dixon, joined us. She was a woman who spent a lot of time screaming at us when we were trying to visit, Alicia and myself, the Benchlands campground in order to deliver the court order to folks living in that campground to let them know they didn't have to be there if they didn't want to, that the Ross camp was not yet being, that there would, the city had no right to drive people into the Benchlands until such time as there was an actual order. And this was before the judge made his final ruling that ordered people out of the Ross camp in, I guess it was early May. Or late April.
You ever said they were going to enter the
property? Well, actually, you said you were calling. We didn't ask you to call the cops.
You guys
called
me.
Okay, can we just...
Okay,
let's just agree that nobody's going to enter. And
we don't agree. Nobody's tried to enter.
Okay. Oh, okay.
I don't agree
with
that.
We're just standing.
But tell me why we can't enter. If we give you our name and you search us or whatever you need to do.
Because of Salvation Army policy as well as the policy of the city at the moment to not allow visitors at the camp.
At the Salvation Army, the place at the county camp where they were running the Salvation Army was running it, what, 4 days ago?
That was actually the city.
No, it was Salvation Army.
It was for a couple of days. Then it went to the city.
Well, here's my issue is that I am involved in a federal lawsuit, and you have plaintiffs in there. So by not allowing us to speak, you're actually prohibiting evidence collection, and you're stopping from us
I'm more than happy to. I mean, they can come out, and they can take the shuttle out, and they can talk to you guys. I mean, that's perfectly fine by all of us.
How do we contact them?
Well, I need to speak to them, though, and I can't necessarily wait for a shuttle to bring them outside.
Well, if you want to create a list of people, I can't tell you who's actually in here and who isn't due to client privacy.
I can't either because of what happened and the displacement of everybody. So when people were displaced, they were guaranteed alternative shelter, and that was a couple of different locations and or nowhere. So the thing is that... You have some of my plaintiffs in here, and I don't actually know all of which you have in here, but I know definitely you have Rafael Saldana, and I'd have to go down the list, but you have a couple of my plaintiffs in here that I definitely would need to speak to.
What's your name?
My name is Philip.
My name is Eric.
Okay, Eric.
Nice to meet you.
Eric, I'm Robert.
Hi, Robert. It's nice to meet you.
I'm Alicia.
Fair enough. And what's your name?
Alicia Cool.
Alicia Cool. Nice to meet you, Alicia.
Nice to meet you.
Okay.
What's your position, Eric?
I'm the executive director of the program.
Ah, last name?
Oh, Snickars. S-I.
I'm Norse, by the way.
Norse, okay.
I'm Posner.
Yeah. And you're who?
Posner.
Okay.
And he's with Huff. I'm with Conscience in Action.
Okay.
And she's in charge of the legal proceedings.
Okay. Well, and I'm president of the Santa Cruz chapter of the California Homeless Union.
Oh, great. Okay, cool. Okay,
Eric,
so
what's your last name?
Snickars.
How do you spell that?
It's like the candy bar, only ARS.
Ah.
And hold on a second here.
So how would I go about getting a hold of Captain Harold and gaining permission to visit my plaintiffs? Plaintiffs that I'm helping represent in this lawsuit.
Okay, hold on.
I actually have his contact information here. I just want to write down...
How often is he on scene?
When he chooses to come here, actually. But you can call him up, he'll answer. He'll talk to you. He's been talking to people, so...
She was very nice to us at the last place.
Would you say Saldana? Is that what you said?
Yes, Rafael Saldana.
Okay, if he is in fact here, and I can't, you know, confirm or deny, you know, whether or not he is here, I will be happy to pass the message. How do you...
Well, I have a list, actually. They would be Shannon Vidmoska, Michael Sweat, Desiree Quintero, Santos Mendez, Sonny Lopez. I also know that Mark Hemmersbach is here.
Mark
Rafael Saldana, Juan Macedo, Vanessa Montoya, and Crystal Olsen, just to name a few. And anybody else actually is a potential litigant in this federal lawsuit as well. So I would also need to gain access to them. Anybody who's been displaced or is currently in shelter in the city of Santa Cruz right now is involved in this federal lawsuit, because it all also includes all others similarly situated. So anybody who's homeless or sheltered, I need to have access to for questioning, discussion, things like that. And they also have the right to participate in this federal lawsuit, so they need to know that.
This, of course, is all through them.
And the other issue, which you mean, she didn't disagree with us. People who happen to be homeless shouldn't be in a prison. And being deprived, well, being deprived to have visitors is a prison. I was a chaplain in a federal penitentiary for 3 years. I know what it's like when people are deprived of visitors.
Okay, well, this is, and a lot of people, it's under my impression.
I've been to prison, and I've
a lot of people are here under essentially duress because they have no other option, and this is the only option given them.
When people don't have the right to have visitors. For the city or the Salvation Army to by the way, where you and I agreed last time, you made
a safety issue, and that needs to be understood.
But you made.
And the woman who says it's a safety issue is Lauren Dixon, as I said, the woman who spent some time screaming at us as we were at the Benchlands campground. I was walking around with Alicia distributing the court order that advised people they could return to the Ross camp if they wanted at that point. She seems to be a much more determined follower of the policies of the Salvation Army, as she, which involved, it seemed to us at the time, no visitors, and that now may have shifted. And then we're going to be playing some. I'm going to be playing some audio about that shortly. But you're getting a sense of what it requires to get them to open up. And you also should understand that at this same campground, between the months of March 2018 and October 2018, they allowed no visitors to come in to the campground. At least that was their official policy under the city. It's now, of course, being run by the Salvation Army, but it set up essentially a no-go zone. And not only could people not visit, the people in the camp could not come out and meet people outside unless they did so on shuttle buses. Although I understand there may have been some informal, kind of under the covers, behind the scenes looseness in terms of these policies, but those were the official policies. And people who wanted to follow those policies to the letter, like the security guard out front, and Lauren Dixon, the assistant manager of this campground, or one of the assistants, who was the manager also, or at least one of the assistants, who tried to deny us access to the Benchlands campground previously. It seems to empower that kind of bureaucratic prison yard mentality, masquerading, of course, as a public safety need. The public safety pretext has to do with they're claiming in their guidelines. I was reading the guidelines that were sent to me, and I'll be talking about that more on Sunday in my longer show. The Salvation Army guidelines say, well, there's no sidewalk, so it's a safety risk for people to walk out of the camp. Doesn't persuade me. People use the paths along both sides of that the Highway 9 all the time, and it's not illegal to do it. So it's clearly, it seems to be an attempt to pander to fears on the parts of the neighbors. And indeed, Susie O'Hara and it might have been her, it might have been Tina Scholl, or it might have been other people at City Council discussing this issue. And when they justified it, they said, well, we had to do it because the neighbors required it as a condition of being put in, as though the city can't put up people in its own yard, which they could have done at Depot Park, too, if they'd wanted, if they'd had the balls and the ovaries to stand firm against community bigotry. But they didn't. And that's up to them. That's their choice.
Development point last time, which was, if you want to come in, you need to sign your name, and we may even search you.
Right.
That's totally valid.
Right. But none of the shelters allow visitors. Like, the Salvation Army doesn't allow visitors. VFW doesn't allow visitors. We're not going to allow visitors. It's the same. Okay. And those are the only options being offered right now in the city of Santa Cruz are prison-like structures that don't allow visitors.
That's right. I mean, it is.
And this one that we're standing in front of actually has barbed wire on it as well. And may I ask you a question since we're all here and you're the director, because you can probably answer this. It's under, I've been told that your hold harmless agreement and your agreement, entry agreement, is not voluntary, it's mandatory to stay here. Can you confirm that?
I'm not sure I'm following your question there.
There's a form that is a hold harmless agreement. I believe that's the title of it.
Okay.
And it also includes the rule structure and a bunch of things that you will agree to when you move here. Can you confirm whether or not that's mandatory or voluntary?
Oh, you mean mandatory to actually stay here?
Right.
Yeah, you do have to sign that.
And that was something that Susie O'Hara either lied about or was confused about in court. She gave two actually opposing answers to that same question. And the reason that question is important is that it requires people to surrender a lot of their rights before going into the city alternatives, supposed alternatives to the Ross camp. And for them to claim they have alternatives that involve surrendering their rights means essentially that they don't have alternatives. It's like getting into a religious program as a condition of a shelter. That was held by federal courts to be a surrender of your rights. Now, this judge, of course, that we were with, Judge Davila in San Jose, didn't find that to be the case. Or if he did, we didn't get to hear about it. It did not influence his final ruling that upheld the city's power to declare Ross Camp a public hazard and to move people. They claimed that they had adequate shelter for people outside the camp, which, of course, they don't.
He would like to stay here, yes.
Okay, so that is mandatory.
Yes, it is.
And that has been said by the director on May 5th. That's the director saying that at 1220 River. The hold harmless agreement is not voluntary. It is mandatory.
See, I think Susie O'Hara told us something different the other day. So
really?
She was in error, perhaps.
As a matter of fact, she said it in court under penalty of perjury that document is voluntary.
But maybe she changed her mind. You know, there could be reasons for that. But it seems interesting that there's this discrepancy.
Well, I have heard from the residents that it's mandatory. You're confirming that it's mandatory. I have every reason to believe that it's not a voluntary document. It doesn't look like it's voluntary as it's written. It was told to me by Mark that it's basically your key to getting in. If you don't sign it, you can't get in. And you just confirmed that.
Well, that's my understanding, unless
right.
Somebody's changed the policy.
You're about to say something. I'm sorry. What were you going to say?
Actually, I'd like to talk to you all without anything being recorded.
I know. I apologize for that, but it's legal.
I'm not questioning the legality.
Yeah, I mean,
it's actually for our protection. A lot of people have said things that are, you know, basically untrue, had said that we've said things. It's basically to protect us.
This is a record.
Okay,
so
no, I understand.
It protects you, too. You're welcome to get a copy of this. I'd be happy to get you a copy if you'd like.
Oh, that's not my worry. I just want to talk to you guys.
No, and I understand. I understand. Yeah.
Well, if you want to talk to us without it, I mean, I think we've gotten everything that we need as far as questions. Do you have any questions that you need on the record? Because I can turn mine off and we can have a quick discussion. I don't mind saying that.
I spent 39 days in the Parchment Penitentiary in Mississippi. I was also a chaplain at the penitentiary in Atlanta for 3 years. In those penitentiaries, prisoners could have visitors.
Okay.
This is unacceptable.
And
I'm not blaming you guys.
Actually,
I understand you're going by the policy.
Even have more
now, can someone come out and talk to us, or you don't allow that either?
You would have to talk to Captain Harold about that.
But right now, you're not allowing it.
I'm not even allowed to talk to media.
I understand.
We're not media.
Okay.
I'm not a media.
Okay.
I don't have a press card.
Okay.
And I'm with her trying to document for her purposes. But, I mean, the issue is, can you go in and talk to these guys?
And there it sounds like I'm not being entirely candid because I am media. He was advised of this later, and he didn't express any objection to my playing this, so I'm adding that as a kind of an additional fact. We actually then talked to this guy, Eric, at some length afterward, And he may have been helpful in facilitating things, and we'll see how that goes. I tend to be skeptical, as you'll hear in the next interview that I did with Phil Posner, which happened, I guess it was 3 days later, because Monday was 3 days ago. But let's hear the rest of this.
Hey, can you come out if you want to? There's some people outside who want to talk to you, or you can't. That's not. Will they be evicted from here if they walk out independently of the shuttle? Yeah, that's what I thought. I just want to make sure.
It's the low visibility. We can't have people come outside of this gate. Those are the rules.
Again, low visibility, giving the lie to the supposed safety nonsense in the contract or in the guidelines that describes, which I got a copy of today, the reasons why people are not allowed to leave on foot or arrive on foot who live there.
You guys can talk to Catherine.
So if they did leave on their own accord and have their free right to constitutional travel, they would be kicked out.
If they did so independently of the shuttle.
The rule is that you can be removed if you don't follow the rules. And one of the rules is that you have to take the shuttle on and off the site if you want to stay here.
Do you have a set of those rules we could take a look at?
That'd be nice. That'd be helpful.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you, Lauren.
How long have you worked with the Salvation Army as the director?
Can I talk to you off the record?
Yeah.
The conversation was off the record. And here's the phone call I made today to Phil Posner, who was able to talk to Captain Harold of the Salvation Army, who was Eric's superior. And here is some of what Phil had to say.
Line with activist from Conscience in Action and Rabbi Phil Posner, who is about to go out and do some meeting with the community and hawking his book. But he's also, when he's not doing that, he's doing a lot of other things. And one of them seems to be meeting with the Salvation Army's boss, Captain Harold, who Conscience in Action has had some concerns about because of some apparent restrictions on visitors, which we encountered, you and I, Phil, when we went down there a few days ago. But that apparently is changing, or they've got some new guidelines, or maybe the boss wasn't following the old guidelines. Anyway, what happened? What's going on?
Well, as you pointed out, you and I and Alicia went over there last week and were not allowed in, even though the director, Eric, was very thoughtful and attentive to our concerns, but basically said that we needed to talk to Captain Harold, the head of the local Salvation Army.
And, of course, Alicia was there because she's got she's a liaison with the Camp Ross, former Camp Ross law litigants who are trying to, you know, give evidence about what's been happening with the destruction of Camp Ross and how they're being treated now. And we were stopped initially by the security guard who Alicia had previously had trouble with over at the Ross camp parking lot. Where he kept approaching her, apparently phoning the police, giving stories that she described as false, that she was a drug dealer, and he didn't use that approach here. But even the head of the program, Eric, at the time, he was personable enough, did not let us in to talk to any of the people there, but simply told us to go talk to his boss, right?
Right, and you know we rightly felt that. Residents in places like River Street Camp, wherever, should be treated as human beings and not as prisoners. So we took a pretty strong line, and as you know, at yesterday's Conscience in Action and Huff meeting, we said that we were going to have a press conference and express our indignation about the situation. However, I also knew that I had a good link with Captain Harold because he's also on the board of the Association of Faith Community, and using making use of the kindness of their president, John, he facilitated communication. And
well, you're on the board of the Association
of
Faith Community.
I'm on the board, and so is Captain Harold. information, and today, I had called three times, but finally today, Captain Harold called me, and we basically had a good discussion, as I indicated in the email that I sent to our fellow activists. In fact, he even compromised on one issue, and he not only agreed to make sure that the camp was open to all individuals, but he even agreed that they could stay longer than 30 minutes as long as it was discussed with staff there.
Well, you know, it's interesting because these guidelines that he's put out, unless they're new guidelines that he just made up, they don't really, it's a little nebulous about that 30 minutes. It says that it's a little unclear whether it requires prior approval from, you know, the...
I don't think so. I think that's a separate statement. When I discussed this with him, I'm the one that made the suggestion, unless previously agreed upon with Salvation staff, meaning 30 minutes or previously agreed on. So, in other words, somebody, as I understood it, we can always take this. You know, this is a perfect question that we can ask next Monday, but my understanding was that if Jim and Joe wants to visit Frank Stein in the camp, and he wants to be there for an hour, if he says to whoever's there, I want to stay an hour, they're supposedly going to let him do it.
Well, here's what it reads. This is under the guidelines. All visitors, excluding case management and service providers, must limit their visits to 30 minutes unless previously approved. Not with permission at the time, but previously approved.
Okay, that's okay.
Well, let me finish. With TSA staff.
No, I'm looking at it. It's a good point. And
but notice the next sentence, Phil. Salvation Army staff must receive previous client approval for each visit. So that means if you walk up there and the guy doesn't have a phone, you can't meet with him unless you've had a previous agreement with him. And this was the reason, I think, although they didn't even offer us that when the three of us came up on Monday and tried to get access, maybe it was, I think it was Monday, to, you know, the camp to talk to some of the people Alicia wanted to talk to, two people she knew were there. They wouldn't even tell them, you know, you got someone outside who wants to talk to you. They wouldn't let them walk outside the camp to do it because you're not supposed to walk outside the camp. They're using this preposterous notion that they have a security problem because there's no sidewalk there. I'm sorry, I don't buy that one.
You may be right, and he wants to be at the press conference. It was my understanding that anybody could go in as long as their search and all that stuff. So.
Right, well, these guidelines don't look like they were just created after your conversation, and maybe they were.
No, they were. He said he was going to revise the guidelines.
Okay, well, I would, I'd be curious to see what the previous guidelines were, but, you know, good that, you know, that the guidelines are kind of revised, and I also want to point out on his behalf that they do talk about pets being allowed, you know, and I think there's another thing, they allow you to keep your one bicycle, you can't have bicycle parts, and a lot of homeless people work on their bicycles if there's not much room in there.
I think that was all stuff that was there before, but...
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, I'm obviously pleased that, you know, this is better than confrontation, and I'm really pleased that he wants to be at the press conference to answer questions and any other concerns people have.
Well, that, I mean, you know, that's, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm hopeful... maybe I am hopeful. Hard to say, but I think that let's see. I just wanted to find one more comment on here that I wanted to. There is something that seems to be an improvement from the previous management, which was under the city and Susie O'Hara, which said that, you know, there simply were no walk-ins or walk-outs. This talks about that they make. They make exceptions. Clients with medical needs, employment schedules, and school schedules can receive exceptions to these guidelines with documented needs. So I think they were actually doing that sub rosa with Susie O'Hara's management of the earlier camp, but I'm not sure. In any case, I thank you for, you know, clarifying that. Anything else you want to say about what you've observed?
I want to make the point that when I called him back with my last suggestion, and I reminded him that he was going to talk to the city manager about the barbed wire, he said to me, I've already put in a call to Susie O'Hara and to Martin Bernal. So I think he's really trying to be as accessible as they think they can.
Okay, well, the difference between you and me on this one, Phil, as usual, is you take people's good intentions as somehow worth something, but I don't give a shit about their good intentions. What I care about is whether, A, they're effective, and, B, whether they're willing to then continue doing what their oppressive masters or the contract makers or the city tells them to do in spite of their good intentions. See, that's the problem. It's not that everyone doesn't have good intentions. People who end up doing the worst things have good intentions. They really do. I mean, a lot of us do. So anyway, good work. I'm glad you're trying, and it's it can be rather trying, but there you are. So what can I say?
That's what I love about our relationship, is because we make an effective team because of your basic, more cynical viewpoint about.
It's not cynical. I'm trying to demand that they're actually
optimistic viewpoint makes a great team.
Well, I think now I want to see you go to the Calvary Episcopal Church and demand that Steve the sextant stop running people off the grounds and denying them.
I do want to deal with that.
And I hope to hear from you a report on that by next Monday, because I want to make sure that doesn't happen. Or, alternately, if you can't get them to do anything, I would ask you to say, to chastise Steve if you see this happening, and to escort people around and say, if you want to run him off the property, you got to run me off the property. Because
have you talked to Steve Pleitch about this?
Yeah, I mean, he knows it's happening and he ignores it.
Okay, you know, well,
and I mean,
I want to talk to Steve and ask him who he thinks I should talk to about this.
Yeah, well, you know, you could talk to the Calvary Episcopal Management. But, I mean, the real issue is to do what you were threatening to do on Monday, which was, and Alicia tried to stop you and did stop you, when you said, you're not going to let us in? Well, I'm walking right in anyway,
right.
You said to the security guard and to Eric, the director. And that's the kind of courage and the kind of, you know, basic principle that it may not be the most, mellowest thing to do, or even the most tactical thing to do, but at some level it's the most direct thing to do, and I want to see that kind of direct action happen. I don't want to hear you saying, well, he's agreed to talk to Martin Bernal. Oh, well, they've agreed to have a chat about that. I don't want to hear about that. I want to hear about the results, and if the results don't happen, I want to see us trying to enforce to the best of our ability humane and decent conditions for people, and getting the real changes going. And I think you do too, actually.
Right. You and I don't. Right. It's only slight difference in terms of tactics, but believe me, I've learned things from you as well. So, for example, one of the things that I think you know that I did, because I sent it out to everybody, I purposefully sent what we were going to do on Monday with a press conference and expressions of indignation. I sent that out as a statement, including to some appropriate people who I knew might facilitate this issue, and sure enough, that's what happened, because today I got a call from one of those people who said, Rabbi, you're going to get a call today from Captain Harold, and if you don't, let me know. So that's where I've learned things from you as well. So.
Oh, well, I think that's something you yourself initiated. I would not have put a lot of confidence in that stuff, and you apparently have had some success with it. If it actually happens, and let's see if it does.
Well, it did happen. I got a call.
I know. I don't talk about the calls. I'm not talking about the nicey-nice talk. I'm talking about whether there then is a real change in policy, though, when you walk up to the gate, they say, right, sign here, you get to go in.
Well, you know what? I left a message with Alicia just after we spoke, told her about the guidelines, that she should look at them, and that she should go there as soon as possible to see what happens.
Right on. Right on.
Okay. Thanks. Have a good day.
Thank you, Phil. Bye-bye.
And to wind up the broadcast, here's a story from the Sacramento Bee. The state worker, blood and syringes, Caltrans fined after union complaint over homeless camp cleanups by Wes Ventature. It's a May 9th story, apparently today, updated sometime in the last hour or two. Union complaints over homeless camp cleanup led California's workplace safety enforcer to fine the state's transportation department, the department's union, announced Wednesday. The International Union of Operating Engineers filed a complaint with Cal OSHA in November as part of a broader effort to prod Caltrans into adding protections for workers who clean up human waste, used feminine hygiene products, and needles when they clear homeless camps under bridges and along roadways, said Steve Crouch, the union's director of public employees. Now, you understand that saying clean up human waste, use feminine hygiene products and needles when they clear homeless camps is nice speak for destroy homeless encampments, eliminate homeless survival gear, and place homeless people outside without any protective gear whatsoever. That's what they're doing, and that is what they want. And they're concerned about their protections. And the reason I'm including this is because of a video response to this by a Berkeley attorney, OSHA Newman, which I'm going to play after I finish reading this story. That is not in their job specifications, Steve Crouch, union's director of public employees, said. Caltrans workers were hired to maintain the highways and bridges, so they shouldn't really even be out there destroying homeless homes. The union's Cal OSHA complaint said Caltrans District 3 workers lacked blood-borne pathogen training and the equipment they needed to clean up homeless camps safely under the Vietnam Veterans Bridge on U.S. Highway 50 in Placerville. The union has also filed a grievance with Caltrans over the cleanup work and expects to enter the arbitration proceedings in November, Crouch said. He said the department should provide training, equipment, and a pay bump for workers tasked with cleaning up human waste, or it should hire outside contractors specialized in biohazards. It's sort of like, concentration camp guards in Auschwitz saying they need more protection from the lingering bad effects of Cyclone B gas on them occasionally, which causes increased illness at home, you know. Or they need better biohazard suits when they're clearing the debris of Jewish bones later. Caltrans clears dozens of homeless camps every day, according to records obtained by McClatchy through the California Public Records Act. Dozens of homeless camps are being destroyed every day. Got it? Its spending on outside contracts for that work more than tripled between 2013 and 2018 as the number of homeless people living in California swelled. The number of illegal encampments along the state highway is growing rapidly, Caltrans spokesman Matt Rocco said in an email. The ever-increasing challenge of responding to this problem is of great importance to Caltrans. Job duties relating to performing illegal encampment cleanups, notice illegal, because I mean that means that they don't deserve homes, right, have been appropriately assigned to Caltrans maintenance workers in accordance with the California's Department of Human Resources specifications for those positions. Caltrans is already using qualified contractors for homeless encampment cleanup in certain situations. The department is facing a civil rights lawsuit in Alameda County Superior Court in which homeless Californians allege Caltrans crews have illegally seized their property. Can you imagine? Relatives of a homeless woman who was killed in an accident during a Modesto homeless camp cleanup in August are also suing Caltrans in Stanislaus County Superior Court. I believe that she, I'll read more about that perhaps on Sunday. A Cal OSHA official said in an email to the union that citations issued May 2nd came in response to the union's complaint, but the citation doesn't specifically address blood-borne pathogen training or equipment. The citation faults Caltrans generally for its failure to review all investigations of occupational accidents and illnesses, of course, of the workers that destroy the camps, not of the people who get the illnesses as a consequence of the destruction of their camps, not of the homeless people that suffer the consequences of these destructions. And instead, you get some citations that the Caltrans authorities are getting for not providing adequate training for their occupational workers and protection, and for not training all employees on the department's injury and illness prevention program. Cal OSHA fined the department $850 for two citations. Cal OSHA cited the Department of General Services last summer over its policies for needles and other sharp objects in its hazard assessments following a union complaint over workers having to clean up after homeless people in Sacramento's State Capitol Park. Homeless woman killed in Caltrain accident was a flower child with a roller coaster life. That's a related story. Another one is you don't bulldoze people. California highway homeless camps grow dangerous. Where on Cal Expo property could a homeless shelter go? Family of woman killed by Caltrain crew clearing homeless encampment files claim. Second suit filed against Caltrain in women's death. Husband says he's rightful heir. All these I will try to go into when I come back on Sunday, which is most likely. If you have stories between now and then or you want to reach me with questions, give me a call on the Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom line at 423-4833. Thanks.
Patient. And so saddened by his passing. Rest in peace, dear Uncle Dennis, great show host, friend, leader, one amazing pirate of the air.
And then you say, I hope you feel about baby.